The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your happiest, most fulfilling, and healthiest life. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Dr. Garth Davis, and we're going to be talking about all things protein. Dr. Davis graduated from the University of Texas in Austin and went on to attend medical school at Baylor College of Medicine, graduating in the top 10% of his class. Dr. Davis completed his surgical residency at the prestigious University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, where he was elected to the position of Chief Administrative Resident. He is certified by the American Board of Surgery and is a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and a fellow of the American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery. He's also boarded in medical management of obesity. Dr. Davis is the author of two books, Proteinaholic: How Our Obsession with Meat is Killing Us, and The Expert's Guide to Weight Loss Surgery. Having spent nearly two decades in the field of surgical and medical weight management, he's a recognized expert in initial bariatric procedures as well as revisional bariatric procedures. Dr. Davis, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to talk about protein because it seems when you look at macronutrients being protein, fat, and carbohydrates, there's a lot of information about good carbs versus bad carbs. There's a lot about saturated fat versus poly and monounsaturated fat. And in all of these conversations, it seems like protein and certainly the different types of proteins get exonerated from these conversations of how the macronutrients are linked to health. So I kind of wanted to talk today, really in two parts. One is how much do we need and, kind of this obsession with getting enough protein. And then what type should we be getting? Because obviously all of these macronutrients are essential, but the quality makes a big difference. So maybe if you could start and just talk us through, how much do we need? We see protein everywhere in protein water, protein in a lot of marketed stuff. And do we need to be buying these products to get the protein?
Yeah, I mean, that's the crux of what hit me years ago as I was really getting into nutrition and, what's the problem with Western disease? And what I was finding is, I was so into protein. And in fact, my first book, which was The Expert's Guide to Weight Loss Surgery, if you look in the nutrition section, it says eat protein, make protein the first thing in your meal.
And so I was a proteinaholic.
Yeah. It was like, whoa. And I even say in the other book, please excuse me for what I said before, because we make mistakes. And that was a huge mistake because as I started to see it, what happened is actually I found out that I wasn't healthy. So here I was, a weight loss doctor, and I was putting weight. And there's this kind of almost God complex you get with doing weight loss surgery where here you are, you've cured this person, they've lost 200 pounds, and you feel like, oh my God, I know everything about weight. But you don't know anything. You just, I cut their stomach in a way that made them lose weight. However, 2 years later, they started gaining back weight. And our number one thing, I would go to these weight loss conferences. And can you imagine you go to a weight loss surgery conference and it's a week long and we don't talk about food at all during that week. And if we do talk about food, the only thing we say is tell your patient to eat more protein. So a really big thing in the weight loss surgery community is eat more protein, eat 80, eat 100 grams, eat 120 grams of protein. These people could barely fit it in. And my patient's like, I'm struggling to get my protein. And I'm like, well, you need to eat more protein, make it steak, make it chicken. There should be fish. Everyone's constipated. Everyone's sick. And then I go and get a life insurance policy and I find out I've got really high cholesterol and hypertension and fatty liver. And I'm like, well, first off, doctor, heal thyself. So I started looking at things differently. I decided I got to kind of step outside the box a bit. And you look at it, and it's kind of interesting because we are so protein obsessed, like you bring up. Like, we are like, there's vodka with protein in it. I mean, that's, that's how crazy we've gotten about protein. But if you look at it, we're the sickest country in the world. We have one of the shortest life expectancies of any civilized country. We've got the highest diabetes rate, hypertension, you name it. And yet we get more protein than any other country in the world. And in fact, if we're the worst and you start looking at the best, they eat very little protein. If you look at the blue zones, which are the societies that National Geographic looked at that have the most people over living over 100, they tend to average about 7% of their calories from protein, whereas we average about 15 to 20%, and yet we're trying to get even more. And this kind of really struck me, and that really started me on this journey of looking into, you know, how much protein do we really need? And of course, that's a pretty good question. You know, the RDA have been studying this for a long time. The recommended dietary allowance for protein is basically 46 grams for a female and 56 grams for a male. And you would think that those numbers were like the bare minimum. That's what you barely need. But that actually is the optimal number. So when they did these studies, what they found was a much lower level of protein that was needed. And that they needed to add a standard deviation or two in order, they actually added two standard deviations to make sure that there was nobody who didn't get enough protein, or such a small percentage of the country wouldn't get enough protein under those situations. And so that's how they came up with 56 and 46, is they added two standard deviations to the mean, which means they really tried to make sure that everybody got covered. And yet that number to us seems low, like really extremely low. And in fact, a few years later, MIT did a study looking at protein utilization. And they looked at, you know, they used these amino acid assays and with nuclear medicine. And it's not the most accurate way in the world, but they upped it a little bit to about 0.8 grams per kilogram of lean body mass. Now, somehow everything gets lost in translation. So the 56 and 46 is basically is the 0.6 grams per kilogram lean body mass. And they upped it to 0.8. But then somehow in society, we said 0.8 grams per pound, which is not what it is. It's grams, kilograms per lean body mass, which is a lot less than per pound. And the number just kept going higher and higher. And what I found is, as I started looking at the diets of the healthiest people, it's the diets healthiest in fruit, you know, heaviest in fruit and vegetables and fiber. Fiber seemed to be the answer, not protein. And when you look at it, we get more than enough protein. Everyone's over 56 grams of protein, everybody, you know, getting double that. And yet people aren't getting enough fiber. So I'm telling my patients they get fiber and, you know, for a snack, eat an apple. And then I'm getting back my patients' dietary logs, and their dietary log, I look at their snack and it's a beef jerky stick. And I'm like, well, what happened to the apple? And they're like, well, there's no protein in the apple. And, you know, I'm banging my head because I don't know about you, but I've never seen a protein deficient patient. I mean, I've seen a calorie deficient patient who's also protein deficient, but I've never seen anybody get enough calories and be protein deficient. I've never seen that in 18 years of practice. And so I think there's this real miscommunication about that.
No, I would echo that, you know, from being in practice. I think a lot of people associate protein as building muscle and with satiety. And I think that's the push, really, of just I need to stay full and I need to make, you know, I think when people refer to the term, you know, clean protein a lot.
Yeah, that cracks me up. Clean protein cracks me up because what do they mean by clean? Because it's not clean, right? I mean, the protein we eat, like imagine cooking a chicken breast. You have to basically go in there armored up and gloved up, and you better wash the plate that you just cooked the chicken on, and you better singe it to the point that it's got harmful carcinogens in it because you've burnt the protein just to kill all the bacteria. I mean, to call it clean is a little bit odd to me. And all protein comes with some harmful stuff. I mean, all protein comes with AGEs, which are glycolate end products that we know are carcinogenic. When you cook them, they get heterocyclic amines. They've got saturated fat, which we know is a problem in raising LDL cholesterol as well as other things. It's got endotoxins in it and causes inflammation. I mean, I've always been curious about what the clean protein concept is, and I see these clean diets and it's got chicken in it. You know, what's clean about chicken?
Yeah, I agree. I think there's probably more miscommunication about the role of protein in a healthy diet than any other food ingredient. I know a lot of my patients, when they switch over to eating healthy, they describe that at least every night now we have a baked piece of either chicken or fish.
Right.
You know,
where did they, because you know, the funny thing is when I started doing the research on on food. And I looked at the Epic Data Study. And it's always interesting to me that, you know, how little doctors in general know about nutrition, because the Epic Data Study has got to be the biggest study ever done on food and nutrition and its health outcomes. And, you know, it was done in Europe. And the database is now 14 years old, I think, or 15 years old. Followed 500,000 people in 10 different countries with culture-specific questionnaires, looking at how people eat. And one of the big studies when they looked at the database was looking at what foods are associated with weight gain over time. And the number one food associated with weight gain is clearly meat and animal protein, and specifically chicken, which we eat. You know, we eat chicken. That's our health food. You know, when I tell people that chicken's associated with weight gain over time, they think that's crazy. It's our health food. But what you got to understand is this idea that protein is satiating is a little bit funny. A lot of the studies where they looked at protein for satiation, they were comparing protein drinks versus just pure sugar drinks. And so, of course, protein is going to be satiating in that situation. But when Dr. Holt did a really good satiation study where he took all kinds of different foods, had people eat them, measured their satiety scores, measured how much they ate at the next meal, et cetera, et cetera. And the most satiating food you could possibly eat by far is a baked potato. I mean, that is the most satiating food you can eat. And that seems to somehow have been lost in translation with all this protein fuss that's out there. Barbara Rolls did some great stuff. I don't know if you know her work looking at volumetrics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, her studies are phenomenal. I wish everybody would look at her stuff, because there's clearly satiation seems to come in fiber. The more fiber you add, she did a lot of stuff with soup and, you know, continually adding more and more vegetables and fiber to soups to kind of hide the vegetable intake, so to speak. Really was associated with much better satiety. And if you think about it, you could eat a gigantic salad or you could eat a 4-ounce piece of chicken and they'd have about the same amount of calories. And so really, when you look at satiation per amount of calorie absorbed, the salad's going to win out. Yeah, sure. If you have I think one of the big problems is a lot of people decide they're going to eat healthy, go on like a plant-based diet, but still seem to try to calorie or portion size. So they portion size this tiny little salad, and then they are really hungry afterwards. But you should see my lunchtime salads. They look like, you know, pyramids full of food. And it's extremely satiating with very low calorie content.
And, you know, when you're referring to protein, you know, and this link with disease and obesity, to clarify, you're referring mostly to animal protein, not the plant proteins.
Right. Yeah, there's a difference. Proteins are basically made up of amino acids. The difference between animal protein and plant protein is going to have a couple things. It's going to be what comes with the protein, so it's important. You know, when I meet with a patient, we don't talk at all about protein or carbs or fat. Those words aren't mentioned. We talk about whole foods. So I hate breaking down food into its component parts, because what is protein? I can't stand it when I go and order a salad, you know, and they say, like, would you like protein with your salad? You know, and I'm like, what do you mean? And they're like, well, do you want a piece of chicken or do you want some steak? I'm like, well, steak is as much fat as it is protein. So you're asking me if I want fat with my salad? And, you know, the waiter's just like, can you please just let me get on with my job? But the point being that, you know, we should be talking about food, not just protein or salad. But when you look at animal protein versus plant protein, if you're looking at just the protein part, they do have different amino acid fingerprints. So there's this idea that plant foods aren't whole proteins, and they actually are. I mean, all plants have just about all the amino acids, at least all the essential amino acids. They just have it in different quantities versus animal protein. And so we think, you know, it's the typical American thought that if some is good, more is better. And so, you know, you need certain branch chain amino acids, but do you need them in these huge quantities where you eat them and then not only do you eat them, you drink shakes with them and then you take pills with them. And it turns out that some of these amino acids could be really harmful. So for instance, leucine, which is an essential amino acid and we need to have it and it is important for muscle growth, et cetera. But having high levels of leucine stimulates IGF-1, which we know does lead to cancer. It also sets off the mTOR pathway, which we know leads to aging, and it may actually be one of the big drivers of aging. And so this idea of having more protein means that you're getting more of some of the amino acids that aren't good. We know methionine feeds cancer cells. We know that, for instance, in plant protein is much higher in glutamic acid, and glutamic acid will eventually be turned into glutathione, which will eventually cause, you know, very good vasodilation and nitric oxide production, and that lowers blood pressure. So it might be one of the reasons that we see great control of blood pressure with plant-based diets is because people are getting high glutamic acid versus people who eat high-protein diets and get hypertension. So there is a difference in that way. So it's kind of a combination of what you get with the protein. Like you eat a piece of steak, you're getting heme iron, which we know is very oxidizing and damaging. You're getting, you're creating inflammation because of endotoxins, saturated fat, all those things that come with it. And then you're also getting high leucine and methionine, which may not be good in high quantities.
Yeah, and there's so many points in what you just said, which I think are just so important. There's the association of different proteins with the diseases, like what kinds of proteins do you need to eat or avoid for hypertension, for cancer, for longevity, et cetera, that I'd like to, kind of get into a little bit. And then the specifics, what's so interesting about, when you look at research is that some studies are population-based studies, right? They're observations, what types of diets are associated with whatever variable you're looking at. And then some are mechanistic, right? You're looking at why is it that what we're observing is the case. And you mentioned heme iron, you mentioned IGF-1. And I thought maybe if we could talk about the link with the disease and then, talking through what is it about the different sources of food mechanistically, heme iron versus right. non-heme, and maybe talking about those specifics because they're so important, but you never hear these terms mentioned.
Yeah. I can't. People do such a bad job online. I see in social media, people like, there's so many non-experts out there trying to give advice, and they go on PubMed and find one article, and that's their proof of concept, and that just isn't how it works. Like when I study a disease process, I want some kind of epidemiology, but it's got to be good epidemiology. You can't have univariate analysis. Like you can't say, but let's take for example prostate cancer. You can't say that in Japan they have less prostate cancer and they eat less meat, therefore less meat causes prostate cancer. That's a univariate analysis. You can't do that. You've got to control for everything else they eat, other toxin exposures. Maybe they don't check PSA as much as we do. But that can lead you to a pretty good epidemiologic study. So you could say, okay, there's a difference in Japanese. Well, let's look at a migration study. Let's look at Japanese in America. Do they get as much prostate cancer as they do in Japan? No, they get more. So that leads you on another study. Then what you really want is you want a prospective study that follow people for a long time and actually looked at a real change instead of a cross-sectional study where you're just looking at one moment in time. And so Harvard Health Study, health professional study, followed thousands of men for many years, and they found that there's a definite association between animal protein, especially dairy, and prostate cancer, a very strong association. So, that's pretty good. So now we've got an epidemiologic study, but that's a correlation, not causation. So then we need to have some kind of mechanism of action, because if this is all correlation and we don't have a mechanism of action, this might just be by chance that we find this. So then you got to look a little bit deeper. Why is this? Well, it could be several things. It could be heterocyclic amines. But what they really found in the studies is that the IGF-1 goes up a lot with this dairy consumption, because dairy consumption is high in leucine. And we know that IGF-1 alone is associated with prostate cancer. So, for instance, if you look at people that have acromegaly, so they're born with high IGF, making high IGF-1 levels, they tend to get early and aggressive prostate cancers. And so there's definitely this correlation between IGF-1. So that's one mechanism. There's a bunch of other mechanisms we could go into that may be cancer-causing in animal protein, but that's the one that they've really focused on when it comes to prostate cancer. So now we've got a good epidemiologic study that did a multivariate analysis, meaning they controlled for weight, they controlled for tobacco use, they controlled for all those things, and they still found that dairy was definitely associated with prostate cancer. We've got a mechanism of action of how dairy could cause prostate cancer. Then we want to do some kind of randomized controlled trial. And so Dean Ornish did that, where he took a group of men with high PSA levels and early stage prostate cancer, and he put half of them on a plant-based diet and the other half on a normal diet. The normal diet people, the PSA continued to go up, and they went on to get surgery or radiation, and the group that went on a plant-based diet had a dramatic drop in their PSA. And in fact, if you took their serum and dripped it on prostate cancer cells, it killed the cancer cells 8 times better than the people on a normal diet. And so now you kind of had a proof of concept. And so it really takes all of that. It even takes more. It takes, you know, multiple other studies. So the epidemiology should be from around the world. But it takes that kind of breadth of knowledge in order to come up with these concepts. You can't just say, you know, meat causes prostate cancer. You need to have all these different factors figured into it.
No, absolutely. And as you're talking through, just for our listeners, if, you know, maybe we could talk through the differences, if you will, of what comes bundled in a plant-based protein versus an animal-based protein. Like you said, sure. You know, a lot of the plant-based are bundled with fiber. A lot of the animal-based are probably more bundled with saturated fat. And then, you know, the sources of iron are different. So, you know, kind of, you know, there's the what we should eat, as you mentioned, the lentils, beans, fruits, vegetables, seeds, nuts, more plant-based, and then the why. In how that's different and what it's bundled with.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a big question.
So
huge.
Yeah.
It's a big question because there's so much that we could talk about. So we could talk about microbiome. And our microbiome is becoming more and more important as we study these things. And what you see is that people on high fiber plant diets have a much different microbiome, and the microbiome produces more short chain fatty acids, which we know are anti-inflammatory and protective. So that fiber that you eat is food for the bacteria in your bowels. Whereas if you're eating a high protein diet, specifically animal protein, and you are not getting the fiber, then you're not going to have as good bacteria. There was a great study done in Nature where they took people and they measured their microbiome, and then they just put them on 2 weeks of a plant-based diet. And in those 2 weeks, they completely changed their microbiome. So we used to think microbiome, once you got it, you had it. And that was it was almost like a fingerprint. Now we know it changes very rapidly with diet. And so as soon as they went off their meat-focused diet and went onto a plant-based diet, dramatically changed their microbiome, and they changed to bacteria that we know are protective against colon cancer and against inflammation. And so microbiome is a big thing that you got to consider when you're eating. The other thing is inflammation. We know that saturated fat causes the cells in the intestine to allow endotoxin. Endotoxin is kind of a byproduct of bacteria. So we know your chicken and your meat is like loaded with bacteria. So we cook the hell out of it and kill the bacteria. But what you don't kill is the bacterial end products called endotoxins, and those get into the system, especially if you eat saturated fat. And when the endotoxin gets in the system, that creates an inflammatory response. And so they've done studies where they've fed people, orange juice and sugar, and that causes negligible inflammation, despite what everybody will tell you. But if they drink cream and milk, their inflammation goes through the roof. And, you know, there was a recent study looking at a ketosis diet causing dramatic increase in C-reactive protein, which we know is an independent risk factor for heart disease. And then there was another study that looked at plant-based diets, and the plant-based diets are great anti-inflammatory. So while you're getting endotoxin and saturated fat with animal protein, with plant protein, you're getting, you know, phytonutrients and things we know are antioxidants and anti-inflammation and actually lower inflammation in the body, which is extremely important. Been some good studies on athletes, you know, taking blueberries, just a handful of blueberries, taking down a lot of the inflammation that they accrue during exercise. So you're missing out on a lot of those different things. But then there's all kinds of other things that are out there. People are studying. There's certain like antigens, like something called Nu5GC that your body could start expressing if you're eating animal proteins that have this antigen, and that might be part of the cancer formation or even autoimmune disease. There's advanced glycolated end products that are higher in animal proteins. When you cook animal protein, you create something called heterocyclic amine, which is a carcinogen. You don't get any of these stuff with plant proteins. So there really is a big difference when you look at the package altogether. And we talked about the difference of the amino acid profile, but beyond the amino acid profile, when you start looking at the actual package of the food it comes in, I mean, you could talk about protein all you want. If you're eating animal protein, you're getting all this other stuff with it, whether it's free range, whether it's organic, doesn't matter. You're still getting all those things. And you're also getting estrogens and things like that. And it's always funny to me when people say, oh, don't eat soy because it's got estrogen in it. It is. I mean, that blows my mind. You get so much more estrogen from a piece of chicken than you do from soy. It's just, it's crazy that would even be talked about. But of course, you know, industry is going to try and sell that false narrative.
Yeah, which is such a good point to point out. And, you know, I think it's really just so helpful to understand the why, as you're, you know, describing behind, you know, what is in those animal sources. And also, you know, pointing out that it's not just the chicken or the fish or the, you know, I think the things that we typically associate with protein, this applies to the dairy, to the cheese, you know, the milk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's always fascinating. I mean, if you look at, so the Adventist Health Study is a fascinating study because they looked at thousands of Seventh-day Adventists in Loma Linda, California. And so you got a group that's, you know, got heterogeneous genes. They've got different genes. They're just, you know, different people living in Loma Linda, California that share a religion. They all believe the body's the temple of the soul. So they treat their bodies pretty well. They don't drink. They don't smoke. They're all fairly healthy. They get exercise. And the meat eaters aren't heavy meat eaters, et cetera. But they were able to look at them because some of them are meat eaters. Some of them are pescatarians, some are lacto-ovo vegetarian, and some are vegan. And when you look at the differences in these groups, there's a pretty dramatic difference between vegans and lacto-ovo. And the lacto-ovo have more diabetes, more hypertension, more heart disease than the vegans do. And so people tend to lump vegetarians and vegans together, but there's a fairly big difference. The lacto-ovo are still getting a lot of saturated fat. They're still getting all these different harmful elements that we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. And you know, mentioned several links to disease, you know, where protein or the animal-based sources of protein are linked to obesity, as well as diabetes, cancer, longevity. And how do we know this? You know, you mentioned there's a lot of ways to get this from data, but what establishes that link? And I think you've touched on some of it, but to maybe add to that.
Yeah, I mean, so I think diabetes is fairly interesting because we think of diabetes as somehow caused by carbohydrates, which is really weird when you think about it, because if you look around the world at the blue zones, they've got, you know, very little to no diabetes and they're eating the highest amount of carbohydrates.
Right. I think it's like 80%.
Yeah. Okay.
Carbs. Yeah.
Yeah, 80% carbs. Yeah, so they eat mainly sweet potatoes and rice. And so when you look at they did, but again, that's a univariate analysis, so we got to get deeper. And so when you look at real controlled epidemiologic studies, going back to the EPIC data study, they saw that animal protein was strongly, strongly correlated with diabetes. And in fact, they found that if you just take 5% of the saturated fat that you eat and replace it with fructose, of all things, you have a 30% decrease in your risk of developing type 2 diabetes. And that's almost unheard of in what our common day thinking is of diabetes. And when you look at mechanism of action of this, the high sugars we see with diabetes is a symptom. It's not the disease. The disease is our inability to process sugars because our bodies are made to eat carbs. We have amylase in our saliva to start breaking down the carb from the moment it gets to our mouth. Every part of our body is made to function on, I mean, the whole Krebs cycle and everything is made to function on sugar, basically, on carbohydrate. And so this concept that the way our bodies are developed is wrong and that we shouldn't be eating carbs is a little bit strange to me. And when you look at the mechanism of action, what really causes type 2 diabetes is that fat is starting to get into the muscle cells, which the main user or utilizer of carbohydrates. And as fat gets into the muscle cell called intramyocellular fat, it interferes with the fat cell's ability to produce insulin receptors. And if the fat cells can't produce insulin receptors, then the insulin is no longer working to put the carbohydrate into the muscle cell, and the carbohydrate starts building up in the, or sugars start building up in your blood. And that in essence is how type 2 diabetes is formed. And you could then do, just like with the prostate, we could then go and do a test. So I always hear these people on ketosis saying that they cured their diabetes. They didn't cure their diabetes at all. They stopped eating sugar, so their sugar levels dropped. But if you reintroduce sugar, if you do a glucose tolerance test, they still have high sugars and insulin resistance. And in fact, in rodent studies and in animal studies, it's very clear that they actually make their insulin resistance worse because they're eating a high fat diet that causes more fat to go on the muscle cells. Now, conversely, in a randomized controlled trial that was done over 72 weeks, which is a really long study, Dr. Neil Barnard did a study that he compared the ADA diet, the typical diet you tell diabetics to eat, versus, which is, a relatively low carb, high protein diet, versus a vegan diet, which was actually really high in carbs. And to give you an example, a typical day on Dr. Barnard's diet for these diabetics was bananas, toast, pasta. I mean, these are things that you would think would drive a blood sugar through the roof. But in the 72-week study, they had a much greater drop in A1C in the vegan group than in the American Diabetic Association group. And that's because what he does with that diet, which is very low fat and no animal protein, is he stops this intramyocellular fat and they become better carbohydrate utilizers. So despite eating more carbs, they had lower blood sugar, which is, very different than these ketosis diets and other diets.
And that is just very, very helpful. And in the time we have left, if you could maybe then share with our audience, what should they be eating? And, I think then the quantity will follow from that.
Okay. So like when I talk with patients, so the number one study, if you look in the literature and you're looking for the best study for weight loss, if you look at most studies on weight loss, they're so short term, like 4 weeks, 6 weeks, who cares what someone loses in 6 weeks? That's completely immaterial. I mean, I've seen people lose weight on all kinds of ridiculous stuff, grapefruit diets and soup diets and all meat diets. It's just ridiculous. But we want to know long-term. And so the best long-term study with the most weight loss ever seen in a long-term study was the study called the Broad Study done in New Zealand, and they had the patients eat a plant-based diet. So it was basically a vegan diet full of whole foods, and they had a list of what they could eat and what they couldn't eat, but there was no calorie restriction. You could eat, doesn't matter, and this is how I do it with my patients. I don't care how many apples, I don't care how many beans, I don't care how much oatmeal, you could eat as big a portion as you want. If you're hungry during the day and you want some fruit, go for it. Absolutely fine. And that was the most weight loss that's ever seen in a long-term study. And it's a really helpful diet because I don't want any counting. I don't want my patients weighing the food. I don't want them having any concern whatsoever about how much protein or how much fat or how much carbohydrates. That's never worked. It never will work. They've done 10 million studies on varying macronutrients and seeing if it makes a difference in weight loss, and it makes zero difference. What matters is that you can eat a diet that makes you feel full, that gives you a lot of healthy nutrients, that doesn't give you harmful nutrients, and that won't give you too many calories. So it's not a calorie-dense diet. And that tends to be a diet that's dominated by whole fruits and vegetables. So typically, for breakfast, I have oatmeal and berries. Like this morning, just for an example, I had oatmeal and berries with an orange and some green tea for lunch. Midway during the morning, I had a banana for a snack. For lunch, I had carrots, acorn, and red potatoes, and a small side salad. And this afternoon, I had a handful of walnuts. And then for dinner, like last night, we had a baked potato with black beans, avocado, salsa, and pico. So that's what my typical days are looking like day in, day out. Very heavy on plants, very heavy on starches. I don't eat any meat. I think you can eat some meat and still be healthy. It just needs to be in much smaller proportions. But what I try to do with my patients is just get this concept of counting macronutrients out. They should never look at food as a pro. I can't stand it when someone says, well, I had protein for breakfast. It drives me up the wall. you know, it just drives me crazy. We're talking about food now. And what food did you have for breakfast? And that is my biggest advice, is to stop all the nonsense counting. Because you know what? In these blue zones, in Okinawa, in Sardinia, in the Nicoya Peninsula, Costa Rica, where people live long, healthy, vibrant lives, they don't count anything. They don't count steps. They don't count anything. They just live their life eating these healthy food that they've been eating for generations.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Gar, thank you so much. I appreciate all that you're doing, you know, in putting out this information in your book and doing it every day with your patients and through your center. I think what you're doing is just so valuable, and thank you for all that you do.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website, emoryhealthcare.org/livewell. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.